I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Nolan, joined by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
And Andrew Brooker.
Evening, gents.
As we take a look at this week in film, including a main release review of Alien Covenant, the latest film in the Alien franchise, as well as all the other bits and pieces. We'll start with the quiz, Owen, where you're losing 1-0.
Yeah, what is it this week? Is it going to be on James Cullen Brassock? Is it going to be on computer games?
No. Well,
to be fair, you could have done it on Alien. I would have been all right.
No, it was, it's the life and times of Andrew Brooker. It's the quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm definitely failing this.
No, it's just a normal quiz. No kind of hidden agenda. A bit different with the scoring. So you get a point for every correct answer. But if you get a question wrong, it wipes all the points you've accumulated.
Bloody hell.
And you have to start again from zero.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So there's a bit different in terms of format, bit more to play for, a bit more at risk. The first question, it's all multiple choice though. The first question, other than Sigourney Weaver, who else was a strong contender to play Ripley in Alien? Was it Meryl Streep, Carrie Fisher, or Diane Keaton?
Oh, man. When was it? 70? I guess Carrie... Diane Keaton, maybe?
Yeah, I see. I kind of want to say Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
But at the same time, really...
I can't imagine. Although there is the kind of... No, I'm going to stick with Diane Keaton.
And Brooker, who are you going for?
Fuck it. Meryl Streep.
Brooker, you're correct. It was Meryl Streep.
Oh, what?
She was a.
That would have been the worst film ever.
It'd been very different, wouldn't it? I don't know about Diane Keaton, but Carrie Fisher. If Alien was 78, Star Wars was 77, and so Alien was probably filming while Star Wars was released, and no one would have really known how good she was in a kind of sci-fi film, and it's a different type of film as well. Meryl Streep, yes, apparently according to DVD commentary on one of the films or releases, she was a close second or another choice to Sigourney Weaver for that role. So out of these three films, other than Alien, out of these three, which has featured Sigourney Weaver? Is it Battlefield Earth, Galaxy Quest, or Space Jam?
I think I know this one.
Okay. I definitely know this one.
Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, you're both correct. So it's a 2-1 to Brooker currently. So following on from that, in which space-based film did Alan Rickman feature? Was it The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Battlefield Earth, or Attack of the Clones?
I know this one as well.
I don't.
Ooh, I will wait.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yes, you're both correct. So it's now 3-2 to Brooker.
He was the voice of Marvin.
Yes. Yeah. So the writer of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was Douglas Adams. Which sci-fi series did he also write for? Was it Blake 7, Battlestar Galactica, or Doctor Who?
I reckon Doctor Who is the red herring there.
You reckon?
Blake 7, I think.
Have to agree with each other.
It does kind of defy the point, doesn't it?
Maybe me saying that was a red herring. When that's
maybe it was. Maybe I'll say Doctor Who anyway, just because why the fuck not?
Right, who's saying what?
I'm saying Doctor Who.
Blake Seven.
I don't have a sound effect for when someone loses their points, but Owen, you have done just that. It is Doctor Who. So Brooker is now winning 4-0. But you could still win. It would only take one incorrect answer for Brooker to lose all his points. Previous Doctor Who, Christopher Eccleston, featured in which Marvel film? Was it Guardians of the Galaxy 1, Thor 2, or Doctor Strange?
Oh, shit. Thor 2?
Yeah, he was the dark elf guy.
He was?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's a 5-1 to Brooker. But we've two questions left, and the format is still
if
all
I just say
for.
Pass, do I lose all my points?
You do, yes.
If I could cheese my way to the end.
Natalie Portman, who was in Thor 2, was in which 90s sci-fi film? Independence Day, Deep Impact, or Mars Attacks?
Ooh.
I think I know this one.
Mars Attacks, fuck it.
Yeah, I think it's Mars Attacks.
Yeah, you're both correct. It is Mars Attacks. So Brooker's now leading 6-2. Mm-hmm. But there is all to play for. Sarah Jessica Parker played a newsreader in Mars Attacks, or a news anchor, chat show host, whatever. What 80s kind of sci-fi family film was she in? Was she in Flight of the Navigator, Short Circuit, or Batteries Not Included?
Fuck.
Fuck. I have no idea.
Flight of the Navigator is about a boy who gets abducted by aliens and then brought back 8 years later to Earth, and it's all a bit weird. Short Circuit is about a little robot dude, and Batteries Not Included is like there's a block of flats and there's some little robot alien things that try to help the people who live there have it not torn down by some greedy developer people.
I know for sure she's not in one of them. But the other two...
She's not in two of them.
Well, no, I know definitely one of the ones she's not in. The other two, it's 50-50. So whatever the first one was you said.
Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah.
Okay. And Owen, which one are you going for?
So we're guessing the one that she was in?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll do the same. Flight of the Navigator. That's the sensible
cheese
thing.
Cheese it to the end and hope and pray.
Well, it's not a set... Really, you should pick something different, because if you're both right, Brooke has won. But if you, yeah.
So
if you're both right, Brooke has won.
Is this the last question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, well, in which case, Batter is not included.
Well, you're wrong, Owen. Brooke is right.
Outstanding.
And I take a 2-0 lead in the quiz, and you are one step closer to watching one of the Emmanuel films.
I genuinely love that you let him talk you into losing all of your points before you lost as well.
Yeah.
But it did seem a bit pointless of it being the last question, him picking the same answer as you.
What kind of quiz is the best of like seven? Did you just get bored?
No, I ran out of time. I was trying to link all the films as well, and I kind of got to a dead end with Flight of the Navigator.
There's nowhere to go from Flight of the Navigator.
No, I couldn't link it to anything. So I was kind of stuck with it, because the guy who played the kid is done nothing after that film, and the guy who played the voice of the spaceship was Pee Wee Herman.
Okay. Definitely played to all of our strengths with the Pee Wee Herman questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I couldn't really go anywhere with it, so I just stopped. Anyway, yes, yeah, so that's me winning 2-0, and I cannot wait for you to have to watch one of the Emmanuel films.
Well, I can wait.
Oh, you're watching one of them. That's it. I don't know which one yet. It depends which one I can find.
Oh, dude, you could have gone full circle and landed back at Alien from Flight of the Navigator.
How?
Veronica Cartwright's in it.
Is she?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. Oh.
Never mind. I mean, I'm not going to do that now.
Well, that's just not putting any effort in now, is it, Steve?
It's a bit late.
Just carry on. Just continue the quiz. It's not over yet.
Just make up questions.
Until you make up the answers as well. That's the fun bit about it. We don't care anymore.
Yeah. No, let's carry on. There's some news. And Owen, it is you've found this news. I'm not too familiar with the guy who it involves, so I'll let you talk about him.
Yeah, Powers Booth has died.
We haven't had a good obituary in a while now, have we?
No, we haven't. So
2017 isn't killing people at the rate 2016 was.
Exactly. Our obituary corner has kind of had to be shelved until today. But yeah, Post Booth, he's, I mean, I knew him really as Curly Bill in Tombstone, and I knew him in Sin City. And of course,
I thought you were going to say Curly Watts from Coronation Street then.
Yeah, now you remember who he is.
Yeah.
No, and he was the bad guy in Sudden Death as well, with Jean-Claude Van Damme, of course. But I think probably his most famous role is Deadwood, which, oh, Brooker, I know you're a fan of.
I am a massive... He was so good as Cy Tolliver in Deadwood. He was just... He was kind of the polar opposite to Ian McShane's loud and leery, sweary guy. But he was really calm and quiet and collected, but equally as nasty, and he was so good. I can't believe... I looked it up this morning... Deadwood finished 11 years ago. I had no idea it was that long ago. I still watch it now as if it only just finished.
Yeah, it's one of those weird shows, wasn't it? That came around the same time as The Wire and The Sopranos and other sort of big HBO things at the
when
time.
When HBO really were in their prime.
Yeah, the so-called golden age of TV, right?
Yeah.
Where Fox were bashing out 24 and Prison Break. You know, and of course he was in 24 as well, Post Booth.
Yeah, yeah, played a vice president, if I remember right.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. I think that was what was on the IMDb. I don't remember. I've never seen 24. But I,
dude!
Yeah, any of it. Never watched it. I think because I missed the first season, and then I was like,
I can hear Callum's like head exploding right now.
I can imagine. I can imagine. But, yeah, so Deadwood was one of those that came around. That was a little bit under the radar, wasn't it? Even stuff at the time like 6 Feet Under, which was more kind of understated than the showy Deadwood.
Six Feet Under was massive when it was on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I missed it completely. I didn't watch it till Sky created Sky Atlantic and all of 6 Feet Under ended up on there.
I watched it when it was first on, and then I went on holiday and missed an episode. So this was like before the days of... Just record it.
For Sky Plus and Catch Up TV.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I missed a couple episodes and then came back and I was like, oh, well, never mind. You know, it was kind of interesting, but never went back to it. But I bought the box set on DVD, never finished that. But Powers Booth wasn't in 6 Feet Under.
No.
He was in Deadwood, which I have never quite gotten into either.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to watch... My dad used to love it. I remember he used to watch it when it was on TV. And I used to sit down and watch it sometimes and just think, it just seems like lots of swearing and aggression and not much in the way of story.
That's the best bit. Like, literally, the amount of times Ian McShane yells the word cocksucker, it's a thing of absolute beauty.
But that's all it seemed like it was when I tried to give it a go. And I've never really... been back to it. Well, I did sort of half watch the first episode, but it was recorded off the telly and it was in really poor quality, so I gave up again. But yeah, no, I mean, as far as I know, it's one of his most lauded roles, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the thing that I think most people now are going to remember him for. Was
Sin City.
Yeah, but perhaps Sin City in terms of films, but definitely Deadwood is his most iconic character.
Yeah. Yeah, a shame.
What I've been watching now, we take a look at the films we've seen in the last week or so, not at the cinema. Why don't you start us off?
Okie dokie. I watched a film by a guy called Mark Lester, who is, of course, the director behind such classics as Roller Boogie, Poseidon Rex, and Dragons of Camelot. You know, that Mark Lester. Oh, him, yeah, Mark Lester.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was he the one from Dragons of Camelot?
That's him, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Mark Lester.
Yeah, a film about dragons from Camelot.
Mm. He also made a film in 1985 called Commando, which you might have heard of. And that's what I watched this week. I watched today, in fact, because we got to this afternoon and realised I hadn't actually seen anything worth talking about on the podcast. So I quickly snuck in an hour and a half of Arnold Schwarzenegger shooting people and generally saving his daughter from bad men. That's essentially the plot, really.
Does he have a particular set of skills?
There are many parallels between this and Taken. It is all about his daughter gets kidnapped and he goes to save her. You know, he's...
There's more rocket launchers in this one, though.
There is, yes. There's a couple of rocket launchers, grenades, machine guns, Uzis, magnums, you know.
Ice creams.
Yeah, magnums, cornettos,
loving the
Soleros.
Mr. Whitney of the bad guys. Yeah.
A few zaps that are just randomly about. The weird thing is about Commando, right? You can honestly take it at face value as this very earnest, cheesy 80s action movie, right? But I also think it's a bit more clever than that. I think it's weird in that a director like Mark Lester, who just makes crap,
churned out Commando. Yeah, he made Showdown in Little Tokyo. You leave that man alone.
Oh, yeah, that is true. He did make Showdown in Little Tokyo. I will retract my statement that it's a quality action movie. But the thing with... Okay, the difference between Showdown in Little Tokyo, which is a buddy cop movie, and Commando, is Showdown in Little Tokyo is just a buddy cop movie with Dolph Lundgren and Brandon Lee, is it?
Yep.
Yep. And Commando is, I think, a weirdly positioned deconstruction of, like, masculinity and kind of what it means to be a man. You know, what is a man? What should a man be? Because I think, okay, so if I give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. Now, you both have seen Commando, right?
Recently, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you've seen it recently. So do you know what the first shots of Arnold Schwarzenegger are in this?
Well, the first
shots
arms.
Of him. Exactly.
Chopping wood and then him carrying a fucking great log. Or is it
well, way? It's before you see him chopping the wood, it is like the first thing you see is a close-up of his like bulging bicep.
Yeah.
As he's like carrying a massive log on one shoulder, like it's nothing. It's
just all There's testosterone, no like it oozes from your screen.
Exactly, yeah. He is a manly man. There's all this symbolism going on. You know, he's got massive arms. He's just a hulking muscle. You know, then it's him chopping the wood, like you say. So that's the first time you see him. You know,
manly.
In terms of...
I bet that dude's sweat tastes like Budweiser.
When like you first see him, that's what you see of him. Do you remember what his first line of dialogue is, though?
I'm going to say no, because otherwise I'm just going to try and play out the whole opening scene in my head.
Yeah. The first thing he says on screen is, why don't they just call him Girl George? It would cut down on the confusion.
Yeah.
Because he's looking through whatever magazine it is and it's got Boy George in it.
Yeah.
Those two things together, I think they really set this up as, okay, this isn't just about, oh, he's great because he's a man. It's like a kind of analysis of, well, this is what a representation of a manly man is. Is it? I don't think it's even... I don't think it does it to criticise or anything like that. I think it just represents the most vivid interpretations of a heterosexual man, right, as a hero and what that is.
Yeah.
And I think it's an observation more than it is a criticism.
I watched it a couple of months ago at work with nothing to do. I had it on my iPad because, yay, Netflix.
Yeah.
But literally, because I think if I'd have watched it maybe 4 years ago, I probably would have said the same thing. But now I look at it and go, that's just him telling really shit dad jokes.
It could be.
It's the kind of bollocks that would come out of my mouth now, absolutely.
But I think it probably is. And, it, you know, but why it's not a particularly natural sentence. And I think it has kind of relevance to what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think because of the fact that it's the first thing he says after the first time you see him. I mean, that's all you need to know about his character, right? He's
Pretty
a
much.
Dad. He's strong. And he thinks, you know, why don't they call him Girl George? He's not male. He's not a man. He's not he's not a figure that he can identify with, right? That's basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
And even throughout the film, there's these, you know, repetition of things like she says, I can't believe this macho bullshit as they're scrapping around a hotel room, you know, and these guys eat too much red meat. I mean, again, it's all this repetition of that kind of thing. And even like at the very end, you've got the showdown between Bennett and Matrix, right? And Bennett says, I'm not going to shoot you between the eyes. I'm going to shoot you between the balls.
Yeah.
Which again is like the idea of it's worse to be emasculated than it is to just be shot in the head and die. So I think it is like this observation.
Especially from a dude who spent the entire film walking around in a chain mail vest.
Who is full of gay iconography, you know. He's wearing a leather, he's wearing leather trousers. He's got like a string vest. He's got a gay porn star moustache. I think it's all, yeah.
It's a proper Freddie Mercury tash as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's amazing. Exactly. So I think there's all this kind of extra stuff that's going on here.
No, because next time I watch it, it's going to be Arnie beats the representation of gayness.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't want to watch that.
I think it's a very... I don't think it makes it an uncomfortable watch. I just think it's an observable fact.
But it does make it very 80s now.
Yeah, yeah. But then, like I say, you could just watch it as that 80s action film. Trying to look at why it's so cheesy was quite interesting. It isn't one that we've particularly covered in film studies. This is just something I watched, and I think now, just kind of for the first time, really try to pick it apart a bit more than just watch it as Arnie shoots some guys. But saying that, it is still a lot of fun as Arnie shoots some guys and has lots of one-liners.
It is one of the best Arnie shoots people films.
And just like full of great, great little one-liners, like him eating green berets for breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a green beret. Well, I eat green berets for breakfast. You know, you said you would kill me last. I lied. I had to let him go. All that kind of stuff, you know. It's just like, it's weird as well. I was saying to, because I watched it with Elisa and we were talking about, like, Schwarzenegger. He could not have been a movie star if he was around in, like, if he was trying to, well, he tried to do this in the 70s and it didn't work. You know, Hercules in New York just was a complete flop. If he was around in the 60s, it wouldn't have worked. If he was around in the 90s, like, emerging in the 90s, he wouldn't have worked because he wouldn't have been cool enough to do this.
No.
And so he, like, smack bang right in the middle of the 80s, Terminator, Commando, Predator, those sort of films all together. It just was the perfect guy at the perfect time. So, yeah, I mean, he just fits the role of John Matrix exquisitely. There's lots of... I mean, I the first time I saw it, I loved it. Second time I saw it, I think I liked it less. And every time I've seen it since, actually, it's just improved again. You just see more in it.
I remember watching this on VHS, my mum's next door neighbour taped it off Sky Movies. The only person on the estate that had Sky Movies at the time. That's how fucking council estate we were.
Hmm.
But yeah, it was on the same tape as Predator and RoboCop.
Oh, man.
Remembering they all came out around the same time, I must have been 7 when I saw all those films. I'm surprised my mum isn't in prison.
Yeah, I think I saw Predator before my teenage years and loved it. And Terminator, I watched Arnie in Terminator when I was the first time I stayed anywhere that wasn't home. I think it was at my grandma's, and I think basically my mum and dad just palmed me off on my grandma for an evening of like quiet. And whilst I was there, my grandma had a little TV in the spare room. And I was like, can I watch the TV? And she's like, yeah, sure. And I was like, this is fucking brilliant. You know, I was about 7, I think, and Terminator 2 was on. And so that was like my first introduction to Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I fucking bawled my eyes out at the end of it, of course.
To be fair, I'm a grown man now and I still do.
It still has that effect, yeah. And it absolutely terrified me. Scared the living shit out of me.
Wow.
But I think watching stuff like that early, I don't know, I think it has like a desensitizing effect. Whether that leads to people becoming serial killers or not, I don't think so. But in terms of the effect that these movies then have when you're older, it probably does lessen it. But also like has that strange like affinity to it because it's just... Yeah, I love action movies. And I think Commando is a very good example of one that's doing what it should do, but doing more than that as well.
Got more brains than it's given credit for. 90%
Absolutely, I genuinely think so. Also, weirdly, it kind of ties into Alien Covenant because of the whole aspect of this like emasculation of men and stuff.
And Arnie has a surprise cameo in Alien Covenant as well.
Mm. There's lots of things I've seen in this now that, having watched Alien Covenant recently, I think, oh, yeah, I see. They're both doing similar things in different ways. So yeah, it's like as Brooker just said, it's on Netflix as well, so it's worth a watch if you've not seen it for a while.
Okay, Brooker, what have you seen?
So I finally managed to get hold of a film that I've been desperate to watch. This it's Jessica Cameron's Truth or Dare, which is a bit infamous as well. I mean, I think it's quite well known. I don't think it'll ever come out on DVD. Or Blu-ray or anything over here, because it's rather nasty. But I managed to sweet talk my way into getting a copy sent to me.
How did you manage that?
By constantly hounding Jessica Cameron on.
No, really.
Seriously.
She could have done it from the Foul Critics account. She follows us, and for a year she used to tweet the same thing every single day. And Steve and I would get notifications on our phones every single day from Foul Critics because Jessica Cameron was sharing her interview with us.
Nice.
It was kind of nice, actually. But
yeah, I mean, yeah. I think the first time I heard of the film was with the interview that she done with Mike.
Mm, Mike Shawcross.
Yeah.
He covered Fright Fest that. Was that 2014?
2014, yeah. The film was made 2013. It went to Fright Fest 2014 because he'd done the interview and he'd done a review for it as well.
Well, yeah, he interviewed Jessica and Ryan Kaiser, who I think is in Truth or Dare.
I think it was one of the first things I read on the site before I had anything to do with you guys, like, at all.
Oh, wow. Amazing. So and we've got Mike to thank for that.
I have a little bit, yeah. Because then not long afterwards, I saw her in To Jennifer, because she played Jennifer. So yeah, hounding people for copies of films. Yeah, I was very lucky to have this one sent to me. So I finally got to watch it, and holy shit. Just holy shit.
From what I gather, very twisted.
It's nasty, like really nasty. But I wanna say it's really nasty. But I fucking loved this film. It was absolutely brilliant. This film, I think, can be defined with what is probably my favorite line in the film, which is literally, cutting off my nipples is not the same as ripping off a Band-Aid.
Right.
There's not an awful lot plot-wise to the film. It's a group of people who get famous on YouTube-ish by doing extreme truth or dare. And they have a TV interview. It turns out, obviously, it's all staged because you can't kill people on screen and keep doing it. An obsessive fan decides to take it a little step further and forces these people into a proper real-life game of truth or dare, with very, very, very extreme consequences. What's interesting about this film? Okay, so I wasn't entirely sure what I was letting myself in for. I was kind of sure what I was letting myself in for, but I wasn't expecting half of what I got. Obviously, everybody knows the game, Truth or Dare. You choose truth or dare, and then you have to do one or the other. You either tell a truth that no one knows, or you do a dare. So the first couple of times these people at gunpoint on film, first couple of times it's their turn to choose truth or dare, they choose truth. And some of the darkest shit comes out of these people. Like, really dark. There's incest. There's paedophilia. There's one of them used to be a man.
Hmm.
And I thought, what the fuck is going on here? So for a little while, you're like, okay, this is quite... I'm not sure where this nastiness comes from, or, you know, where this, because it's quite infamous for being really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where this is coming from. It's pretty hardcore, and it's like confessions from these people, if you like, but it's not, you know, it's not nasty. And then someone chooses dare. And the first dare that's done on screen is someone has to eat a bunch of smashed up glass and you right. get to sit and watch it in quite horrible detail, and it all goes downhill from there. I'm loath to start saying some of the best bits in case people do get a chance to watch it, because some of the stuff you see is a complete surprise, is really fucking horrible, and some of it really did come close to my line of start watching it through my fingers. It was so horrendous. But at the same time, I really want to talk about it. I don't want to spoil it, but I really want to talk about some of it because it's just so gross and so wrong. But I tell you what, let's suffice to say, some of my favourite ones include forced masturbation with a wine bottle.
I've seen that on Big Brother, though.
I was going to say Kinga?
Yeah.
But it was not followed by... forced... How I don't even know how you would describe this. Necrophilic cunnilingus?
Right.
You have that. But you didn't fucking see that on Big Brother, did you?
for a few years, to be fair.
Yeah.
Pretty tough to watch.
For me, I maybe this is the whole desensitized thing you were talking about earlier. But I mean, there were some bits that made me go, that was a bit much. Mm-hmm. But I mean, nothing across the line for me. I mean, you know, I don't own an equivalent of a Serbian film, which is just horrendous awfulness. It's still entertaining. It's still very good. It ain't going to be for everyone. I can guarantee you that.
What I know about Truth or Dare, because obviously I haven't been able to see it for all the reasons you've covered, but...
It will never, ever be released in this country. Not uncut.
But it was a response to what I think Jessica Cameron called safe...
Yes.
...horror movies.
Yeah.
It was the Blumhouse kind of saturation of, shit, scary, quote-unquote scary.
Yeah, it's definitely... When you look at it, it's definitely... a response to churned out,
yeah,
paint by numbers, horror by committee, definitely.
So she purposefully went all out to make the most vile and offensive things.
Yeah, from what I've read,
yeah,
she decided to make it herself because the directors on the shortlist for it, the ones that were able to get on board and do it, wanted to cut the violence down, and she really didn't want to do that, which,
yeah,
you know, fair play for sticking to your guns, because it is you know, horribly unreleasable. You know, it's you do limit your market severely by doing that, and to have the balls, so to speak, to do that still is impressive. And it is, dude, you've got to come down here and watch this film.
Yeah, we'll have to at some point. I mean, I'm curious to see. I do find, though, that...
It is very indie horror. It is still a, you know...
Yeah, indie horror's fine, and I can get on board with indie horror when
it's still shoestring budget indie horror with shoestring budget indie horror grossness, but it is very, very good. And again, much smarter than I think a lot of people that watch it. Well, no, that's not fair, because a lot of people that will watch this would be fans.
Yeah, because it's a commentary on the genre. So I think that gives it a bit of credence. Just all-out torture porn for the sake of, like, some sick fantasy realisation stuff. I hate that. I absolutely detest stuff like that. But
I would stick it in the same kind of... Can we say social commentary? I'd stick it in the same kind of social commentary films as, say, Green Inferno.
Is it? Because I think, without seeing it, and it might be unfair,
a response
but like Green
to insane internet stardom.
Okay, fair enough. Well, maybe I just shouldn't say anything until I've watched it.
I mean, that's just my take on it. That's just, you know, there's definitely, there's a lot of I don't know, anger? I don't think it's anger, but it looks like anger at people who have gotten famous on YouTube for doing absolutely nothing. And I do think it's, you know, as much as it's a response to shit paint-by-numbers horror, it does have the feeling of a response to shit internet celebrity as well.
Yeah, as long as it can say why it's angry about that, then I'll be okay with that. But it's this just needless hate towards things that's like manifested as, so we'll cut his dick off or make him eat glass or whatever. That's kind of... Then it feels very...
This film definitely needs beer.
Yeah, yeah.
Pizza. Maybe not pizza, because you probably won't be able to finish it.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely beer.
it's like when they try and make a social commentary horror, right? It has to answer the stuff that it's criticizing, you know.
Yeah, and because I think if it does it tends to fail at that miserably.
Yeah, because if it's just a shallow piece of dirge, then it'll feel like that, and it won't feel like a good movie. I really did like Green Inferno, and I know lots of people dislike it, but I think Green Inferno is beyond just, you know, the torture porn. It isn't just about a bunch of idiots who are just painted as idiots because they're young, who go into a jungle and get eaten.
Yeah.
I think there's more about... I think whatever you think of Eli Roth, his opinion of this SJW culture, as you sort of called it in an interview, of people who want to take credit for doing good when all they've done is like clicked a retweet on something and then hound other people when they don't do the same and say they're horrible people just to feel superior. That's what his whole thing was about in Green Inferno. And I think that came through. My trouble would be with Truth and Dare is if it's just saying people who get famous through YouTube for no reason, aren't they a load of idiots? Let's just make them do horrible things. Then I would feel less inclined to watch it. However, again, I'm not trying to pass judgments on it because I haven't seen it. And I do want to see it because I do think there is possibly something there that's going to be quite interesting. Particularly if that's what you're saying, it is making an actual commentary on stuff.
Oh, yeah, for sure it is. I do think you'll like it as well. I think you'd probably, a bit like me, kind of sit there and go, maybe I need to stop looking at this because holy, holy fuck, that's horrible.
And that's the other thing. It's supposed to make you squirm, isn't it?
Did you get
a sick bag?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. It's awesome. It's gone into my permanent collection.
That's kind of a neat little thing, isn't it?
It is amazing. And apparently, like, if, you know, there's loads of these things kicking around. Like, they all, when they were showing at a Fright Fest, she was handing them out at Fright Fest as well.
Yeah.
But obviously, this is before my Fright Fest days, so I didn't see it there. And I am a little bit sad about that. I would have liked to have seen it on the big screen, but that will never, ever happen, I don't think.
Yeah. From what I gather, it went down really well at the time as well.
Yeah, yeah, it seemed to. And Mike's, like I said, Mike's thing was the first thing I read of it, and he had nothing but positive things to say about it for the most part. I'm really, really chuffed that I finally managed to watch it. I'm really chuffed that I get to talk about it. I wish more people were able to see it, as much as I probably wouldn't recommend it to everybody I know.
Is it one of these proper horror film fans?
Well, you know, you have those films where everybody goes, okay, it's a bit nasty, but you'll probably like it. Like, I'm handing out my copy of The Void to everybody that I walk past. Because I think everybody should see it, and it's genuinely a really good horror film. But it's nothing compared to the violence and nastiness in Truth or Dare, and I will probably just go, yeah, I don't think you can handle that. But it is really good, and if you have a chance to watch it, you know, not just you, but anybody listening, if you have a chance to watch it, absolutely do.
Well, I'm just glad that I've stopped having falls out torture porn tweeted to me every day, because I quite frankly had enough of it.
Now, what's wrong with torture porn?
Well,
it was a constant daily barrage of balls out torture porn.
It was more than daily. It was like you'd think you had a tweet from somebody, and it was just that, and you just again.
What have you seen then, Steve?
I have seen Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Somebody saw Snatch, didn't they? I think someone reviewed that last week or the week before.
It was Tony's choice. Snatch was Tony's choice for the British comedy post-1980s triple bill. I also watched Lock, Stock last week, and so I'm looking forward to seeing... Because you said it was your favourite, right? It was your preferred one of the two.
Not that either of them are bad, but that's probably my preferred one out of both of them.
Is that still true?
Yeah, very much so. And then everything that Guy Ritchie done since is kind of diminishing returns. Ending with what we've had this weekend.
So you're looking forward to King Arthur then?
No.
Back in the movie?
No.
I think it's going to be awesome.
It looks like such a bag of shit.
I think it's going to be really good and surprise lots of people.
I looked at it and I went, I can't even be bothered to go to the unlimited screening I've already booked for it. It just looks so wank.
It could turn out wank, but I...
It will. Undoubtedly.
They've already cancelled their 6-film plan for a franchise, haven't they?
You heard about this as well. They were going to do 6 King Arthur movies.
Hey. Ooh.
Bold.
We don't need a King Arthur cinematic universe.
I would be down for that. I think that maybe Guy Ritchie's not the...
Guy Ritchie's not the man to start off a franchise like that.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's a lot of King Arthur legend out there. There's, you know... a couple of facts. Did you know he was Welsh?
Yes.
First of all. Yeah. So he's Welsh. Did you know the majority of the poems and legends written about King Arthur were French?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No.
They came from France, apparently. I was reading that recently.
Right.
Yeah. King Arthur is like mainly a French concoction of a Welsh legend.
And there's no dragons.
There's possibly dragons.
No.
I'm reading one epic poem, which is like a French version from, I don't know, 15th century or something. And it's translated into modern English. And it's just... I mean, the film can't be worse than that. That is lots of people sitting around feasting for the first half of the book. So, fingers crossed, King Arthur the movie is more than just people sitting around having a feast, talking about what they're going to do.
Well, that sounds like Tarantino's King Arthur.
Yeah, it's basically the first half of The Hobbit.
But anyway, so yeah, I saw Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, which I first saw when I was 13, and I can't remember how I ended up seeing it when I was 13. It definitely wasn't in the cinema. And a few of my mates saw it and thought it was the best thing ever. And that is kind of tempered since, but it is very good.
It's a very 13-year-old kind of movie.
Yeah, but it's obviously starring Jason Statham before he became an out-and-out action hero, and Dexter Fletcher, and some people who just haven't done a great deal since in terms of acting, really, or haven't done any major kind of roles. It's one of the first ones I've seen where it's kind of multiple story threads that tie together. The dialogue's very fast-paced and witty, and it's funny, and it's very quotable. It all comes together well at the end. Vinnie Jones is in it when he could act a little bit. I mean, he wasn't too bad in this, or Snatch, to be fair to him.
That's because he didn't have to do any acting in this at all.
Yeah.
He just took his football kit off.
Yeah. Smashed people's heads in with car doors.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was a very good kind of gangster action film. It was everything that Guy Ritchie's tried to do since and has failed. When he does well, he makes a good film. Cause didn't he do The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I thought the Sherlock Holmes films he did were okay. Snatch was very good.
The second one, the second Sherlock Holmes film, from what I read about it, was they were literally writing it as they were going along.
Right.
It does feel like that when you watch it as well.
Yeah, there was no structure there. It was just, let's film this bit and then what do we want to do? We'll write this bit and he'll do that.
It's not crap. It's just nowhere near as good as the first one.
Mm. But then he makes stuff like Revolver and what was the other one with Jared Butler? Rock and Roll.
I like Rock and Roller. I think Rock and Roller was the first thing I saw Mark Strong in. I love him in that.
But yeah, I just, the 13-year-old me loved Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and the 30-year-old me still likes it a hell of a lot. It's not without its flaws, but I think it, for a film that's got multiple story threads, it all comes together quite well. It works.
Yeah.
Did you watch the normal one or the director's cut?
I think the DVD I've got is the normal one. I also opened the DVD case I had for Snatch as well, so I was going to watch that again, but didn't in the end. But it's got my original receipt from Woolworths in there.
Oh, yeah?
Cost me £20.
Jesus. 20 quid.
£19.99 for a DVD.
No wonder Woolworths went under.
Not even any Pick-A-Mix on that receipt. Time now for our review of this week's big new release, which is Alien Covenant, the latest film in the Alien franchise, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Michael Fassbender and a whole host of others. The film is a sequel to Prometheus, or it follows Prometheus, and basically the humans are looking to colonize a planet, but they end up going to a slightly different planet because they find is it a distress call or is it just a beacon sign of life or something?
They hear they get interference, the magnetic interference from something, and then it turns out that it's a song that's being played.
Right.
So that confuses them because on a planet that they assumed was uninhabited, they're hearing familiar music. And so, yeah, basically what happens, you get the, I think this is fair game. We're not really spoiling.
Yeah, it's probably worth saying we're going to do a spoiler alert for this bit. So, for this film. So we'll tell you when that's happening. But this part will be unspoiled. Then we'll do some recommendations, and then we'll go back and
exactly.
Yeah.
But there's I think it's fair game to say you're going to end up on a planet. It's not entirely set on a spaceship, right? The reason they go there is because Billy Crudup, who's the captain of the Covenant, the spaceship, he decides to completely divert their mission away from going to this friendly planet that they've researched for years and they know that will be great for setting up their new colony of humans, and think, ah, oh, fuck it, we'll just try this place.
Because nothing was ever likely to go wrong there, was it?
I mean, it's one of those sticks that's been used to beat Prometheus with and no Alien Covenant, in that characters do the most stupid things at the most ridiculous of times.
Insane leaps of non-logic.
Yes. And I think the film's introduced with one of those. I mean, just the first major decision they make in the movie is a load of fucking, like, that would not happen. They were just like, I know they set it up really as Billy Crudup is, his character is the religious one, right? Didn't they call it, he calls himself like a, he, you know, it's almost illegal to be to be religious because you're deemed like a fanatic in this futuristic world. But he basically relies on faith, which doesn't really seem to be faith so much as whatever the fuck he thinks is good.
Yeah.
Right? He's just going to be steered by the hand of God, which in a weird sort of way, I'm not going to say anymore. But, you know, like, because that's the problem we had. We talked about this before we started recording. How much of Alien Covenant can you really talk about before you piss people off for just ruining things? Because it's all built on lots of drip-fed information, isn't it?
It's reveal after reveal after reveal after reveal, and it's this constant flow of what's supposed to be surprises, which we're going to ruin if we just keep talking about the film.
I guess, okay, so we can talk broadly about it, broadly. First of all, I want to ask you guys, what is your opinion of, like, briefly, what is your opinion of Alien? Steve?
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Brooker?
Top two franchise ever.
Brilliant, okay. Aliens, Steve?
It's good.
And Brooker?
Third favourite film of all time.
Well, okay, that's amazing. Okay, and the other two, Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection? Steve?
I haven't seen them either of them for such a long time.
That's fine. Alien 3, I think, is like a prison drama, really, with an alien in it. Alien Resurrection is fucking dog shit. Brooker?
Yeah, Alien 3, I think, is given a bit of a bad rap. Alien 3's assembly cut is amazing. Alien Resurrection is a steaming pile of wank.
Yeah. There's a lot. I mean, that was just too... That was a writer who was wrong for the film in Joss Whedon. It was a director who was wrong for the film and a cast that were wrong for the film.
And a studio desperate to just cash in on all that alien cash monies.
It was a flop for all the right reasons, I think, that film. Okay, so that's those films out of the way. So we've got an idea now of where you guys stand. You've got Brooker, you prefer Aliens to Alien. Steve, you're an Alien over Aliens kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
So, in regards to Prometheus, first of all, good film, bad film?
Bad film.
Amazing film.
Amazing, okay.
I loved Prometheus.
I think Prometheus is very interesting.
I think it would have been far better if Prometheus and this weren't connected to the Alien films.
That is a very good point, because...
Alien... was a really good, essentially a horror film set in space, a bit akin to The Thing being a horror film, but with an alien in it as the menace. And then Alien, you know, then there's good action films in the franchise, and now they start trying to bring in this mythology, which they did in Prometheus with the alien, the engineers,
and how
life was started on Earth. And all, why are we here? Where did we come from? Stuff that's not needed in Alien films. They need to just make more Alien or Aliens. Just make more of that.
I definitely agree with that.
I think the biggest problem is that it's connected to, like you said, connected. It could be completely separate as a new trilogy or quadrilogy. I think it's going
to
be.
I don't think it needed to be part of the Alien franchise. I don't think it would have made Prometheus a good film in my eyes, but it would have made it better if it didn't try and tie it in with something else. And the same with Alien Covenant. I think it would have been better as Prometheus being a standalone series rather than tying in with something, because it just kind of ruins it. In Alien and Aliens and 3 and Resurrection as well, you don't need to know where the alien came from. You don't need to know who made it, who created it. Why it does what it does, who the engineers are. You just need to know that alien's going to try and kill me. It's quite intimidating. Let's deal with it. Or not deal with it and get eaten.
I think there are thematically, there are things that tie them all together. And you think about, do you remember like years and years ago, Steve, when we had Jerry reviewed Alien, right? And he was talking about the idea from Ridley Scott and from H.R. Giger, the guy who did all the designs of the xenomorphs and all that kind of stuff. They together said that the horror from Alien was meant to come really from the fact that it's like homosexual oral rape, right? It's the idea of men being impregnated as opposed to, you know, there's a scary thing in the air vent. It's about actually...
It's about catching that AIDS.
I do remember Jerry talking about that in quite a lot of detail.
Yeah, and I think that is part of what made Alien so good. Is because I mean, it is just full of phallic symbols everywhere you look, right? That's what I was talking about earlier with Commando, in that it's tied to this idea of... kind of masculinity and stuff, and how you emasculate that, and that's the horror in it. And I think that Prometheus continued that theme, and I think it's much stronger here in Alien Covenant, which is again for perhaps the first time since Alien, or maybe Aliens. Yeah, it's all about the creation of life, and not just like in Prometheus, it was about the godlike creation of life. But I think this is about the physical act of creating life. And I think, again, that's where it tries to draw its themes from. But unlike Alien, which was horror, we saw that as like horrific. I think Alien Covenant sees it from a more scientific sort of plight.
It's also a kind of confused film because it doesn't know whether it wants to be like tonally like Alien, or it doesn't know if it tonally wants to be a follow-up to Prometheus and just go into all this mythology and you know, story and where did we come from and morals and artificial intelligence and everything.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't know what it wants to be and it tries to be both and does it badly.
You know, it feels like... Ridley Scott knows what he wants to do with these films, but has realised he's kind of created a rod for his own back. He's got too much background that he's got to fit in, and he's now just kind of cramming.
Yeah,
but just because it's linked to Alien in the Alien franchise, I'm just watching it sort of fed up, thinking you don't need to do this. You're kind of ruining Alien a bit. Like you really don't need to do. Why don't you just make a separate film? Whereas if I was watching Prometheus and then just say this was called Covenant, not Alien, just Covenant. So I was watching Prometheus and Covenant, and it's not tied to Alien at all. I'm just watching that, and I'd be thinking, okay, this is an interesting film with some interesting ideas, or this is a crap film. But I'm not going, why have you tried to link it to Alien and made it just, you ruined a kind of Alien franchise and made it, you know, tried to link it badly and come up with all this stuff that just doesn't feel like what Alien's about.
Hmm. I think that is a good point, because it doesn't... It's a good point in so much you're right. It doesn't really do Alien very well. It doesn't have the horror to it. It doesn't feel like it's part of the same franchise. Whereas I think...
When it is trying to do the horror, all you're just thinking is, well, in a minute they're going to move away from this and start trying to tell us about the engineers and...
Yeah.
The gene splicing and making alien things and that.
It is really, really low on horror and scares and things as well.
Mm.
Like, I would say it's even quite low on actual alien-esque atmosphere, which I thought Prometheus more or less nailed. I know a lot of people disagree, and I'm okay with that, but what I mean is with Prometheus, it felt like an alien film, although it doesn't need to be an alien film, and technically it's not really an alien film. It felt like I was watching an alien film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of what I went into it wanting. I didn't care if it had anything to do with the lore, and I was quite happy to get to the end of it and not see a single face hugger. That wasn't an issue for me in the slightest. But it felt like I was watching the atmosphere felt like I was watching an alien film. This one doesn't.
That's interesting.
In the bits where it's a sequel to Prometheus, it's so good. But in the bits where it's trying to crowbar its way into alien lore, it's so clumsy.
I think the strongest thing is, and it has been with Prometheus, is this whole sort of religious theme to it, which there's no real getting away from. Is you know, it's all about playing God.
Yeah.
You know, Waylon creates, who's a human, creates the android, which is in Prometheus David, and in Alien Covenant, Fassbender's back playing Walter this time. A sort of more advanced version in a lot of ways of David, just more robotic and less human, so to speak. But then, the idea from Prometheus was that David sort of saw himself as a sort of life form, you know, not as a mechanoid, not as an android thing. And I think then this continues that further. So, like, who is the creator here? And it kind of, you know, particularly, like, again, the most obvious one of the creators is the engineers. And, you know, and again, just going back to that, like, thing about masculinity, they're all the engineers that we saw and have seen, they are, like, big blokes.
Hulking masses of muscle.
They're big men.
Yeah.
Right? There's no getting away from that. They're big, bold blokes. And it's the thought that they're the blokes and the alien is always thought of as the queen, right?
Yeah.
So you've got that dichotomy already straight away. You know, the female's the one that's to be feared and the engineer's the one that's creating life. Although at the same time, as you see in Prometheus, the engineers are the ones who see humanity as just like the utter shit stain on the back of their boxer shorts. You know, they're just disgusted to see them. Like when they turn up and they're like, when David tries to talk to them in Prometheus, and he's like, oh, we're, hello. And they're just like, what the fuck is this shit? Just start swiping them off left and right and center.
And part of it from Prometheus that the engineers created humanity.
That's implied, heavily implied. It's
in the prologue or the opening scene.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you see the engineer who's on a planet that looks a lot like Earth.
Yeah.
Mm. But as you see from Alien Covenant, of course, is when they're on the planet of this film, like you see it in the trailer, they see wheat. And one of the things they say is, well, who planted wheat? Isn't it odd to be so far into space and see, like, vegetation that is exactly the same as is found on Earth?
Yeah.
So, again, I think it's I think it would be interesting, though, because what's going to happen, apparently, with Ridley Scott, he's now making the next film in this franchise, which will be a prequel to Alien Covenant. So it's going to be set between Prometheus and Covenant, right? And then the fourth and final film will be a sequel to Covenant.
Which annoys the piss out of me, because the biggest problem I have with Covenant is the fact that it felt like sequel bait.
Prometheus did the same.
Yeah, no, it did, absolutely. Mm. But I don't want to sit and watch a film that feels like it's setting up another two films. And Covenant does that. I didn't, you know, Prometheus did do it. Prometheus did say, okay, we're going to leave this open-ended for a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas whereas Covenant absolutely feels like, yeah, come back in 2 years.
Mm.
Like, oh, for fuck's sake. I don't need.
But that's not even come back in 2 years for the next
no,
bit of the story.
No, it's come back in four or five.
But like, if you watched the prologues that were released for this, right, over the past couple of months.
Yeah, I watched a couple of them.
Yeah, so you've seen the one. There's a prologue with Shaw and David in it. David being Fassbender's android from Prometheus, and Shaw being newly replaced.
It's basically David's diary.
Yes.
From between Prometheus and long after Prometheus.
So my question really is, do we need to see that extended into a longer film? Because I don't think so.
No, it just needs to be a special feature when the Blu-ray comes out.
Yeah. The only thing that's not explained in the prologue is Shaw. Like, exactly where she is now at that point in the prologue, right?
Yeah.
Which is only vaguely alluded to in Covenant anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not... I mean, I'm not saying much, but it's not about Shaw. We can say that this film is all about Daniels and Walter. Yes. Daniels being Catherine Waterston, who's, for all intents and purposes, the Ripley character.
I liked her as the Ripley character as well.
Mm. But what I mean by that, she's nothing like Ripley, but she is the female protagonist who's the lead.
The problem with the film, for me, isn't the actors or the performances. It's not that at all. There's some decent performances, and they're working with a plot where some characters do stupid shit just to move the story along.
Mm-hmm.
It's our bread and butter.
Are you talking about Danny McBride flying the ship too low?
And like, yeah. It's just stuff that people, like, you're obviously sending, if you're going to colonise another planet, you're sending, like, pretty smart people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. If you're in Prometheus, if you're sending somebody to look for what they're looking for in Prometheus, you're sending smart people. In the 2000 colonists in Covenant, like, you're not going to send 2000 idiots, are you? You're going to send people who are probably learned in some field that you will need to colonize a planet. So there will be, at the very lowest, there'll be somebody who knows how to grow crops, and there'll be people who use common sense and logic. So why don't they?
Well, there's how many people on the Covenant? There's 2,000.
I thought it was 2,000, yeah.
Yeah, 2,000. But I don't know how many of those are, because you see lots of
2,000 plus crew.
So they're just the crew.
Right.
So these are 2,000 plus the people we see in the film.
Yeah.
Like the actual people who have lines. So about 2008.
Well, the other thing is, because the crew is so, there's so many characters, most of them, I mean, you can understand why they're reduced to like stereotypes like Tennessee, right? Danny McBride's character.
I love Tennessee.
I thought he was, I quite liked him, but I think that was Danny McBride making him quite like.
I think it was. I haven't seen Danny McBride in much that isn't comedy. So I quite liked him in this. And I know it's got absolutely nothing to do with his performance or anything, but it kind of left me a little at ease at the fact that he's directing a Halloween film. I kind of looked going, yeah, okay, I kind of trust you now not to make, you know, Pineapple Express.
But then it did a little bit of like what I guess would have been called stunt casting, in that it had James Franco in it.
Yes.
And I say James Franco in it because it's been advertised, he's only got a very small part, but lots smaller than I even thought. You know?
Yeah.
But we can talk about that a little bit more when we get into spoiler alert. But I just thought the cast, Fassbender aside, who is just absolutely fucking phenomenal in this film.
Yeah.
One of my favourite performances of his, actually, is his role in here. Particularly for a couple of scenes, which I'm dying to talk about when we get to spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But him, I thought he worked well. Catherine Waterston was okay, but she didn't have much in the way of character to work with. In fact, her best scene, I thought, came between her and Billy Crudup, where he was talking about that he wants to go to this planet, and she was saying that's illogical, there's no reason to do that.
Yeah.
And that set up a bit of conflict between the two. And actually, in the Last Supper prologue, which again, of course, is another biblical reference. You know, you've got covenant, you've got this. There's, I think, Walter delivers the line, something to do with rain in hell, or, you know, from Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. But in the prologue, the Last Supper, you see Billy Crudup, who desperately wants to be part of the team and give a speech and stuff, but no one really pays attention to him. And you see him as the outsider. He's the leader, but actually no respect for him whatsoever.
No.
And I think it really set something up that was interesting for his character that it just didn't capitalise on. I don't know what you guys felt about the crew.
I mean, I didn't mind. Like I said, I liked Waterstone. I thought she was great. I liked Danny McBride. The rest of them, more or less forgettable.
Entirely forgettable, I think, really.
Yeah. I had a mate of mine ask me on Facebook, I think, if it felt like a Ridley Scott film. I was like, no. And maybe,
I think it...
Maybe this is half my problem with it. It just didn't feel like Ridley Scott, for me, when he makes great films, you watch them and go, that's a Ridley Scott film. You know? But
all three of them.
But this is what I mean. But it looks like one of his run-of-the-mill films.
Oh, this was on target for budget. It was in on time. There was
nothing big, special, or clever about it.
No.
And that's disappointing. For a franchise that's so beloved, it needs to be respected a bit more by the people that are making films for it, especially the guy that fucking invented it.
Yeah. Before we get on to talk about stuff that was really, you know, the things that I desperately want to talk about in this film, the only two things I want to say is John Logan, who wrote the script for this, or screenplay for this, who has worked with Ridley Scott before, you know, on Gladiator. I think they worked together on Gladiator. He much improved the script overall from what was in Prometheus, I think, because Prometheus had some very dodgy dialogue in it. I mean, it was a bit all over the place, that one. But also, the only final thing I want to say is the CGI, I thought, was the stuff that was noticeably CGI was just not great. It was a bit weird.
There were a couple of bits there that were very reminiscent of Alien 3.
It could have been made at the same time, yeah. Because it just looked like it just didn't fit. It was too cartoony. It just didn't look right to me. I don't know whether it was technically.
It's got that thing like I said, with Alien 3 done it, with a couple of bits crawling around the ceilings in that all yellow, and the CGI is terrible. We're talking, you know, sick formers in After Effects kind of awful.
it wasn't quite like Asylum levels, but
absolutely not. But it
was just below par, I thought.
I'm scared because I've pre-ordered that film on 4K. I'm not sure I want to watch those scenes. I know the ones you mean. I'm not sure I want to see those scenes in 4K because they may actually ruin a film that I kind of liked. It'll
probably look worse, yeah. But I think general overall thoughts before we go to spoiler alert, and so we can sort of get closer to wrapping this up, because Steve, you're edited this week, not me. But yeah.
A disappointment.
I liked it when it was, I think I said on Twitter afterwards, and I still stand by it. I think it's a good film when it's a Prometheus sequel. It's a bad film when it's an Alien sequel. And I think, going back to the point Steve made right at the start, it just doesn't marry the two particularly well.
No.
I liked it, but it's another film that I'm going to spend an inordinate amount of time defending. And as the time goes on, I'm going to worry if it's really worth it.
Spoiler alert coming up then, but just some recommendations for the week ahead. For those of you finishing listening now, I'm going to go for Netflix has just added a film from last year called Selma, a biopic of part of Martin Luther King's life and the marches through the city of Selma in the USA. Brooker?
So mine is Friday morning at 10 to 1 on the Horror Channel is one of my favourite horror films from the last couple of years, is We Are Still Here.
Okay. And Owen?
I'm recommending a film called The Outlaw Josie Wales, which is Clint Eastwood. I think it might have been the first film he directed, actually. It's a Western.
Great film.
Yeah, from 1976. It is a really good Western. And I think as much praise as Clint Eastwood has gotten as a competent film director since then, and as kind of rough around the edges as Outlaw Josie Wales is, I think he's probably the best film he's directed. It's a quality. It's on Dave on Saturday at 10 p.m. So probably outside of the Dollars trilogy, it's the best Western that Clint Eastwood's done, I think.
So that's all for this week's Fail Critics podcast. Should you not be joining us, spoiler alert, and thank you all for listening and see you next week. Those of you joining us for spoiler alert, that is happening now. The traditional Matt Lambourne warning is going out. If you haven't seen Alien Covenant, don't listen past this point because you will have the film and various plot details spoiled for you. You have been warned.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, created by James Diamond, with original music provided by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, remixed by James Yule of JamesYule.com. You can find us at failedcritics.com, on Twitter at failedcritics, and Facebook at facebook.com/failedcritics. Thanks for listening.
Owen, you wanted to cut lead on a couple of points for spoiler alert.
I really, really wanted to say, and I didn't want to bring it into the previous section, David is by far and away the most interesting aspect to this entire film. And it was like painful trying to talk about Alien Covenant and pick out some of the things that were good about it without bringing into it that David is there as a central character. Because it's a reveal within the film, right? It's played as a, you know, you kind of know who it is, but he's got hood up and you can see long hair to try and throw you off the scent a little bit. But then there he is, flute playing, fingering David.
That is without a doubt the best line in any Alien film so far.
But like,
I'll do the fingering.
It's funny, but like so poignant to the whole point of this film, which is again, because like it's all about relationships, right? It's all about relationships. The crew are all in relationships, like there's pairs of them. They're all paired off. There's a couple who are gay. There's, you know, mostly heterosexual couples. There's interracial couples. It's all, it doesn't matter. They're all just like, the thing is, it's about the pairing of people. And the thing that David cannot do is be in a relationship because there is no other who is of his type. There's no other half to David. And so in that scene, it's his version of like flirting. Because it's that's what he's trying to do. He's found Walter, and Walter is like a type of him. And so he says, I'll finger your flute. Right? I think it is meant to be suggestive. And then he snogs him afterwards, which is, you know, weird to see because it's Fassbender snogging Fassbender. But I think in terms of the whole like thing of the film, the whole point of the film is he's desperately trying to find love. And he can't because he talks about how he thought he had it with, like, he said, I loved Shaw. And Walter says, that's impossible. You can't love Shaw. You're not able to love Shaw, like, physically capable of it. And it's like, it's true. He can't. It's not possible for him. He's imagining what love is. Because I think it's also brought into the film that the thing that's on the table is Shaw, right? You know, everyone goes, you see all the growths and the burst chest and everything is that's Shaw. That's a woman on the table who's been experimented on. You assume that she's been experimented on. And I think that if that was the case, then he didn't love her, did he? Because if he loved her, he wouldn't have used her to create a species that could love him.
Unless he's mental.
Which he probably is a bit bonkers.
And she didn't love him, so he's gone mental.
Yeah, I suppose I am ruling out, you know, I'm assuming that she didn't sacrifice herself for him and suggest that he did the experiments on her for...
And you know. If he's creating a species to love him out of the woman who didn't love him, but he loved,
mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, no, that's true. That is a good point. And, you know, the whole... You see the bit where he's trying to communicate with the xenomorph hybrid thing, and
which both times he does that are pretty fucking laughable.
They're naff. They're both really naff. But the like the one of them where it's the more adult one, where he's sort of face to face to it, and he's talking about how they communicate through breathing or whatever. Right, then Billy Crudup shoots it, and you see the like proper anguished expression on his face. Like, no, you've killed something. How could you kill something? And I think is made even better when you think, well, he just wiped out the race of engineers for fucking jealousy.
Yeah.
Essentially, you know, because they're capable of all the things that he's not. Weyland created Android. Android created xenomorphs. The engineers created humans. He's destroyed the engineers. It's just like bringing it into one big circle. And the fact that at the end, he just goes off with the Covenant. Like, yep, I'm off to make my own race of aliens using you people now.
In the single most like, telegraphed ending I think I've seen in the last year.
But isn't that just like that was the perfect ending for it. I know it's like sneakily trying to play itself off as a twist, as a reveal. But, you know, everyone knows it's David. I think the nod and the wink is we know it's David.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's a twist and reveal in so much as it should be for the audience. The audience should be the ones sort of on the edge of their seats going, oh my God, what's going to happen to this? Is David, this isn't Walter, you know. So when Daniels finds out was quite amusing. I just loved Fassbender's expression in that as he's sort of tucking her in, putting the lid down on it, and you just see the sort of smile come across his face and he's like, off I go. I'm going to go and set my plan in motion. Catch you later. I just thought, fantastic scene. Really great scene to end it on.
Yeah.
I mean, so David, for me, is just like the perfect character to continue the A. I want to see more of this series, this franchise, to see David. None of, I mean, Fassbender's brilliant, but also David is just the most interesting character they've had since Ripley. There's just so many like facets to him and what he brings to the series. But I have realised again, like, we've gone into spoiler alert and Steve asked me one question. I've gone on off for this massive tangent again. So I'm just going to take a step back now and say, you guys can spoil whatever you like now. Free reign.
I don't really have a great deal to say. I'm just disappointed with it, and I just think I would quite happily never see another film in the Alien franchise again and just leave it as it is. I know it's an exaggeration, but for me, these films risk being the prequel trilogy to, you know, for Star Wars, to the Alien franchise. They're not as bad as that, but I just think they ruin.
No, but they're getting quite close to being Hellraiser 6, 7, and 8.
They just kind of they're tarnishing the legacy that Alien left as being some brilliant sci-fi films, right, and then films within other genres as well. And then this just whole engineers and David stuff, it's just, it doesn't work in that franchise. I agree completely that David's an interesting character and you know, doing interesting things and you want to kind of see where it goes. Well, I just don't see why it had to be tied into Alien. And it just keeps frustrating me. I'm just sort of like not bothered by the whole thing.
Well, I don't think it doesn't really matter that it is tied to Alien though, does it? In the same way that...
It does, because you're always thinking about Alien when you're watching it. It's always there.
I don't know if I can't say what you are doing, what anybody else is doing, or that anyone's watching it better than anyone else or anything like that. But I thought that you're right, it doesn't have to be an Alien film. There could be anything that David is creating, right? It could just be, I don't know, tiny little pink men or something, right? It's the whole thing is that, well, I guess they would be tiny little women, but, you know, female things, because that's the... I think it's just the fact that... I think it stemmed from the idea of, well, where do the xenomorphs come from? And then that's expanded as a whole evolution of ideas. Well, where did the xenomorphs come from? Where did the things that created the xenomorphs come from? Where did the things that... the same things that created people? Is it just this massive... like thing that's been going on for, why were the miners called to that ship in the first place, you know, in Alien and all that kind of, well, they weren't miners, were they, whatever they were, but you know,
yeah, they're all miners, weren't they?
Was it mining crew? I often think it's a mining crew and I think, no wait, that's Red Dwarf, it's completely different. But at the same time, just because they are xenomorphs or hybrid things,
I saw them called something else the other day, and I remember reading it going...
I'm desperately trying to remember. Neomorphs. Off. Neomorphs. Yeah. Yes. Because that's what they were called just on set, apparently. I think just because they are... I don't think that necessarily tarnishes it. And it's like the title, Alien Covenant. At first, that really annoyed me. It was like, well, don't call it Alien Covenant. You're already going to shoot yourself in the foot by having Alien in the title. Because it's not an Alien film. And you're just tricking people into thinking they're going to see an Alien sequel. But the more I thought about it, the more it makes sense, because it's not a covenant. You know, covenant is in like a biblical promise type deal, right? They're going off to repopulate another planet. It's like a, you know, but tying Alien into the title actually kind of makes sense in that sense, in that way, because that's what's literally happening, is that David's created an alien covenant instead. But anyway, so it works after you've seen the film, I think. But beforehand, I thought it's just people are going to go in, precisely as Steve said, thinking this is going to be an alien film.
And well, I didn't go in expecting that. I went in wanting it. And I think after Prometheus, people won't go in expecting it. They might go in wanting it, but after Prometheus, I don't think they'll go in expecting it.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But so the whole thing... for me, overall, was a good film. I thought the way that it dealt with James Franco was quite funny.
Well, they fucking Drew Barrymore'd him.
Yeah. I say funny. Funny is not perhaps the right term, because burning him alive inside that tube was quite grim.
Who hasn't wanted to do that to James Franco at some point in their film watching life?
Yeah. But I just thought that was quite good. And I watched the prologue today, the Last Supper prologue, which he's in.
Yeah.
And in that, he's got flu. And he says, I'm burning up. I thought, oh, nice. Nice setup. So the Xenomorphs, let's talk a little bit about the Xenomorphs then, because we're running over time a little bit and I don't want to drag on. We mentioned like the fact that they're created by David. The little one lifting his arms to mimic David. Did you cringe as much as I did in the cinema?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was just...
Just because he looked like he was rehearsing for the Thriller video.
Yeah. I thought the point of the Xenomorphs was they don't see him as a thing, you know, as a person, as a creature. He's just an inanimate or animated object, you know? He's not alive.
It does very much, the thing that it reminded me of, between that and the other one, the fully grown one that he was trying to communicate with,
mm-hmm.
it reminded me a bit of Brad Dourif in Alien 4.
Mm.
When he was trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And the thing with it in Alien 4 was it was kind of, well, the way I took it anyway, it was the way to prove that no matter what they, no matter what they'd done, this thing was never going to be tamed. It was just going to fucking eat you. There's no two ways about that. That's how your relationship with that thing ends, with bits of you in its mouth. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like how that ended how that came about in Covenant. Because I was like, well, for this thing that it's supposed to be this, you know, does nothing, you know, this 100% killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like how now we're standing, playing Just Dance with it.
Yeah.
I cringed, but then actually it wound me up.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what makes the fucking thing so scary, is that it is a, you know, 100% killing machine. There's no fucking around. It just kills everything. But now, you know, now we're playing the mirror game with it.
Yeah. And, I mean, even ignoring all the criticisms of it in terms of, well, hasn't it just completely ruined the whole, like, structure of these, like what we knew about the aliens or the Xenomorphs, that, you know, where they come from. You have an egg and that has a facehugger, and the facehugger pops out a little baby one inside of John Hurt, and then that grows up and so on.
Yeah.
That's kind of, well, where I saw something...
birthing timelines are starting to annoy me as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they both are like... But like... even in terms of, well, where do those eggs and stuff come from? So were these Xenomorphs already present on the planet? Or, I mean, so there's lots of confusing...
He hints at the fact that he's created them.
But then did he laid eggs? I mean...
this is what I mean. I don't care where the Xenomorphs came from.
Yeah.
And it kind of leads into another thing as well, like the bait and switch that Ridley Scott has done twice now.
Mm.
He's ended us up on two fucking alien planets that at the end of he's flown off of. I'm sick of not being on LV-426.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see how all these fucking eggs got there. If you're going to tell me the story of the Xenomorph, show me how that field of eggs appeared as if out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Well, any more for any more?
Just another couple of points. So the scene where it's revealed that David wiped out the planet of engineers. How dark was that? Were
that
you expecting grim. That?
That was quite hardcore. That was very Pompeii-ish.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really good analogy, yeah. Because I saw it in the cinema and I was like, what? Isn't David the one who tries to open a dialogue with these people? Is he just a bit offended because they swiped him aside.
You get the feeling he's pissed because their one representative beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, because the one representative looked down its nose at him, not even as a, like, you know, a communicable person, just as a, ugh, what the fuck is this in this room? Just bat him to one side like a flea. I didn't expect them to do mass genocide like this.
No, it was really grim.
And partly because I wanted to see more of the engineers, you know. But
yeah.
The only other thing I thought was a really good scene was, again, just going back to this whole, like, motif of, like, biblical analogies and stuff, was the scene where Billy Crudup is dying and he says to David, what do you believe in? And he says, creation. Just goes off. I thought that was a nice little joke because it's just to piss off Crudup, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know. It was a good scene. Added a bit of sort of character to David. Not that he needed any more character. He was already pretty fucking goddamn badass anyway. But yeah. So that's really all I wanted to say was about the flute scene, really. That was my main driver for this spoiler alert.
The flute scene, yeah. So, yeah, I think that's it for spoiler alert and obviously for the podcast as a whole for this week. So thank you all for joining us. Hopefully you've enjoyed this week's podcast. And we'll be back, Owen, next week with...
King Arthur.
There we go. Can't wait.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.